So we are in Psalm 52 in our Bible study. Our summary statement for Psalm 52. Psalm 52 pronounces judgment on those who refuse to trust in God, and blessing on those who do trust in God. Go over that one more time. Psalm 52 pronounces judgment on those who refuse to trust in God, and blessing on those who do trust in God. Our outline will be in two parts for this psalm, verses 1 to 5, judgment on Doeg. Verses 6 to 9, David's confidence. I'll go over that one more time. So verses 1 to 5, judgment on Doeg. And verses 6 to 9, David's confidence. Okay, so let's move to our observations. Psalm 52 was written by David, and the superscription ascribes it to him, to the chief musician, Maskil, a psalm of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said unto him, David is come to the house of Ahimelech. So it is directed, as you can see, to the chief musician, to the choir master. There are two Selahs in the text also, at the end, one at the end of verse 3, one at the end of verse 5. Other than that, there's no other musical direction that is given. And the occasion of the psalm is given there in the superscription, which is obviously one of the longer superscriptions that we have in the Psalms. The occasion was when Doeg the Edomite betrayed David to Saul. And that account is in 1 Samuel chapters 21 and 22. So Jonathan had warned David at this point that Saul was going to kill him, and that he had to flee immediately. And so David fled south from Gibeah, which is where Saul was, where his house was. And he fled south toward and went to Nob, which was a town of priests where the tabernacle was at that time. He had no provisions. He had no weapons. And he asked the priest Ahimelech there for food and for any weapons that he might have. And Ahimelech gave him the showbread that was all that he had, the consecrated bread that was on the table, and also gave him Goliath's sword, which had been there wrapped up in some sort of a material. And David also, during his time there, when you read that in 1 Samuel 21, he noticed Doeg the Edomite was there. And obviously that's foreshadowing what's going to come in the account. But David left from there and he went down to Gath, and that's when he ends up, you know, acting like he was insane so that he could escape from Gath. And then he ends up at the cave of Adullam, and he's there alone by himself. And then that's when the people begin to gather to him, and he gathers a few hundred men there at the cave of Adullam before he sets out. Now, this Doeg the Edomite was a shepherd. He was a chief shepherd of Saul, so he was in some way over flocks and overseeing other shepherds, keepers of the flocks. And when none of the men knew where David was, so Saul knows that David is missing and he's looking for him, and none of the men knew where he was, this Edomite, Doeg, offered the information to Saul that he had seen David in Nob with Ahimelech and told him about all these things that Ahimelech had done for David. So Saul had Ahimelech the priest brought to him, and he was questioned. And then he ordered Ahimelech and all the priests slain. Now, none of the men of Israel there in Saul's army that are standing around, none of them wanted to kill the priests like Saul had ordered. So once again, this Doeg the Edomite steps forward and he kills Ahimelech. In fact, he kills 85 priests, we are told then. And after that, Saul ordered that actually all of their families needed to be slain as well. And so they, Doeg and the others, they go to this little village of Nob, and they kill all the men women and children there, even kill all of the animals, the livestock and things that they had. So that was the occasion for this psalm. Psalm 52 is a wisdom psalm. And one of the reasons why I say that is because of the moskel that appears in the heading. We essentially have understood that to mean that this is some sort of an instructive or a teaching psalm in some way. But also, when you look at the psalm, it contrasts the righteous and the wicked. It contrasts their ways and their respective ends, the wicked ending in death, obviously, and the righteous ending in life. Psalm 52 is also what we would call an oracle of judgment. It's somewhat unique among the Psalms that there is a judgment that is pronounced against a particular person. And it's like similar pronouncements of judgment that we might read in Isaiah or Jeremiah or somewhere else. Psalm 52 is connected with Psalms 49 and 50, especially, that come before it, the themes of judgment on the wicked, and particularly judgment on the wicked because they're trusting in wealth rather than trusting in God. And ultimately, trusting in wealth means that that wealth is going to fail them. They're going to be confounded because of that. Being a wisdom psalm, we would also expect to see connections with Psalm 1 and 2. And in fact, there are connections with Psalm 1 and 2. We have a contrast of two ways and two outcomes in this psalm. But we also see the connection with Psalm 2, where we have opposition of the wicked to God's anointed king. I mean, this psalm begins a string of psalms of David, where David is facing persecution and opposition, primarily at the hands of Saul. So there's opposition of the wicked to God's anointed king, but also their downfall. So this would link it with Psalm 2 as well as Psalm 1. The poetic features of Psalm 52, it's a pretty straightforward psalm. There's not a lot in the way of poetic features. And one thing that is unusual about it in the writing is that there's direct address to the enemy. So the first part of this, you'll notice as it starts out, David is addressing Doeg. So it's written to him. So it's written to address the enemy directly, which is unusual in the psalm. Normally, it's direct address to God, complaining about the enemy or asking God to judge them or whatever the case may be. But this is actually directed toward the enemy. It does use some imagery. You have like a tongue being compared to a sharp razor in verse number 2. The being plucked up by the roots like a tree in verse number 5. And David as a saint being like a tree planted in verse number 8. All right, so we want to walk through this psalm, 9 verses, so I'll go ahead and read this psalm. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. Selah. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. That I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. So the psalm opens in verses 1 to 4, and this is where we get the primary indictment of Doeg. It begins with this direct address. Why, essentially saying, why do you boast in mischief, almighty man? So there's a direct address here. Doeg is the enemy in this psalm, Doeg the Edomite, though we could also say, by extension, Saul likewise would be an enemy in this psalm. And really, the psalm itself, as you looked at the text of the psalm, there's enough generality in the way that it's addressed, that it's, though this is directed toward Doeg, ultimately it speaks to all of the enemies of God. Now, this word for boast that is used is actually a common word for praise, halal, and oftentimes it's directed toward God, praise of God. But here, it's the praising of mischief or the praising of evil. The word for mighty man is typically descriptive of a warrior or a military champion, the Gibborim. The word for goodness here is actually the word hesed. So that is the word for God's covenant mercy, most often as it is associated with that. This word is also repeated down in verse number 8. I will trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. So the contrast that David is presenting here is with evil that is being praised. He's praising evil. He's boasting in evil. He's exulting in evil. Evil being praised, and that's being contrasted with God's enduring covenant mercy. In other words, whatever that praise is, it's going to be very short-lived. Even if a man may seem to live his whole life and to get away with evil, so to speak, his entire life, it still is a short-lived and a temporary prosperity. He's going to come to judgment. So rather than exulting in God's covenant mercy, which endures forever, he's exulting in something that is very temporary. When you look at verses 2-4, giving these various charges against Doeg, you notice that all three of these verses, they revolve around the tongue or the speech. They all refer to that. So he's in verse 2, he's devising and working deceits, and that refers to plotting and scheming. In other words, indicating that it's a continual work. This isn't just a slip. This isn't just a mistake that's made. This isn't just something that maybe someone in a moment of haste or anger said something they ought not. It's deliberate. He delights in this. He loves this. He revels in this. Saying that his tongue is like a sharp razor, obviously meaning that it is cutting, and likely refers to the bloodshed. So when you think about the priests and the people of Nob and all of that blood that was shed senselessly, I mean, those priests weren't guilty of anything. Those people of that village did not do anything that they deserved to die, and yet they were slaughtered. Down to the account in 1 Samuel says that it's men and it's women and it's children, even down to infants. And they're animals. All of these things were slaughtered. So all this bloodshed. So David says that his tongue is like a sharp razor. It's cutting and shedding blood. And really, even though Doeg was the one that took up the sword and killed Ahimelech and the priests there of Nob, but it was ultimately his words that set all that up. It was his tongue that got that started and got him in that position to actually shed that blood. In verse 3, he loves evil and he loves lying. And we've seen these sort of things rebuked in the wicked, like back in Psalm 50 in verses 18 to 20. And particularly there, we have references to bearing false witness. And when you look at the account in 1 Samuel, you realize that Doeg did indeed bear a false witness against Ahimelech. When he told Saul, when he gave Saul this report that he had seen David there, and he's talking about all these things that Ahimelech did, what Doeg did was to make it seem like the priest was helping, he was aiding David in rising up against Saul to overthrow him. That's the way that he made it seem. That's obviously the way that Saul interpreted it. And it was not true. In other words, he lied about Ahimelech. He bore a false witness against him, accusing him essentially before King Saul, and it led to Ahimelech's death. Now, in the account, when you go back and David shows up at the tabernacle and Ahimelech's kind of surprised to see him and he's all alone, and what are you doing here? And when you look at that account, you'll notice that David was very careful with his words. And sometimes people get in debates and get hung up on, was David being deceptive here? And what's going on? Well, especially when you look at it compared with Psalm 52, I think it could very well be that David was very careful with his words so that Ahimelech would not become any sort of a willing or knowing accomplice. In other words, he was ensuring, he's protecting Ahimelech, that he's not going to do anything against King Saul. And as far as Ahimelech knew, he was not doing anything against King Saul. So I believe that's one reason, because later in 1 Samuel chapter 22, when David learns about what has happened and what it is that Doeg has done, he essentially states that he had feared that. He was afraid that something like that was going to happen when he saw Doeg there. Obviously, he knew Doeg's character. And so he obviously had in mind some idea of wanting to try to protect Ahimelech, to insulate him from any wrongdoing. So again, we can maybe go back and forth about David's words there, but they certainly were very carefully selected so that Ahimelech would not knowingly be doing anything against King Saul in the help that he gave to David. Verse 4 focuses on Doeg's speech. And again, it was his speech that led to Ahimelech's and the other priests' death, including the inhabitants of Nob there. So what we see here is that Doeg the Edomite has a morality that is entirely upside down. He's loving evil. He's loving lying. He doesn't love to speak righteousness. He doesn't love truth. He doesn't rejoice in truth. He's praising evil. He's rejoicing in evil. So he is obviously in a position where he's very close to King Saul, and he's influencing things that are happening. And again, his morality is just completely upside down. Now, when we get to verse 5, we see God's response, or essentially what David is delivering as what is going to be God's response. So he says that God will tear down or break down Doeg, and again, by extension, all those who choose evil over righteousness. And it's actually, this is the fate of the proud, referred to in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 25, that God will basically break their house down. He'll destroy the house of the proud. And that's essentially what is being said to Doeg here, because he's going to be broken down and he's going to be taken away from his tent or from his place. He's also saying that God will pluck him up, and the imagery there is like plucking up a tree by the roots. The wicked, oftentimes, interestingly, the wicked are oftentimes depicted as flourishing like trees. In fact, Psalm 37 and verse 35 is one of those references where those that are doing evil and delighting in evil and plotting wickedness all the time, and they seem to be flourishing. They're spreading themselves like a green tree. Well, Doeg is going to be rooted out of the land. He's going to be plucked up. The land of the living, obviously rooted out of the land of the living is a reference to the curses of the covenant. In other words, it's a failure to inherit. It's to inherit death rather than to inherit life and land. So the righteous inherit the land. Psalm 37, verse 29. The righteous inherit the land. And that is also their sustaining hope in Psalm 27 and verse number 13. When you get to verses 6 to 7 now, we have an interesting turn in this psalm, because in verses 6 and 7, we're actually seeing the reaction of the righteous congregation. So the righteous congregation, this would be the congregation of the faithful, those who trust in Yahweh, those who are in covenant relationship with Him. And it says here that they will respond to the judgment on Doeg by laughing at him. They will laugh at his judgment. Now, obviously, the same word is used here. God laughs at the raging of the wicked. In Psalm 2 and verse number 4, the people of the earth, they rage, they rebel, they shake their fists and all of these things. And then it says God laughs at them. And one reason why, if we look at Psalm 37 and verse 13, It says that God laughs at the wicked because he foresees their judgment. So he sees all their raging and foaming and plotting and scheming and all the things that they're doing to oppose him, and he laughs at them because they're failures. Every scheme that man can devise to overcome God, to thwart or to hinder him in any of his purposes, is a failure. It's doomed to fail. So God laughs at the raging of the wicked because he foresees their judgment. And the righteous here, we're told, laugh when they see that judgment because it is right, because it is good, because it is holy, and God has judged the wicked. The evil man, we're told in verse 7, he did not trust in God. And that word for strength that is used there is a word that refers to a stronghold or to a fortified place, like a defensible place in a high, rocky mountain. And obviously, as we're going through, we're seeing a lot of terms that are oftentimes associated with the covenant. And the trust that is supposed to be put in God, we have places like Psalm 4:5 and Psalm 9:10, Psalm 13:5, Psalm 21:7, Psalm 22:4-5-9 in Psalm 22, and on and on and on and on. This word trust, it's used as, particularly in a covenantal reference, putting your trust in God. So here, that trust that is supposed to be put in God is said rather to be put in the abundance of riches. And this was obviously rebuked in Psalm 31:46, as well as Psalm 49 and verse number 6 more recently to this psalm. It says also that he is strengthened in wickedness. And that word for wickedness has it has the idea of desire built in. So there's lust or covetousness that is sort of driving a word that speaks of calamity or ruin. So out of his covetousness, he's working ruin and calamity. And in verses 8 and 9 that end this psalm, give us the expression of David's confidence. Now, we have to think about where David was at this point. I mean, when all this occurred, I mean, David is alone. He is obviously very vulnerable. Not only does he have enemies within Israel, but he's got enemies outside of Israel as well. One of the reasons why he had to act like he was insane to get out of Gath. But here in verses 8 and 9, we have David's confidence. And he contrasts himself now with Doeg the Edomite. Doeg the Edomite seems to have the upper hand at this point. And David says, but I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. So this contrast is given specifically with a first person expression. David says that he's planted in the house of God. To be planted in the house of God is to dwell in God's presence. We saw that in Psalm 23:6. His trust is in God and in God's mercy, his hesed. That's where his trust is, God's covenant mercy. His trust is there forever and ever. And verse 9 gives us a direct address to God now from David. The recognition of God's righteousness and the judgment on those who do evil and do not trust him, as well as the blessing on those who put their trust in him, leads to continual praise. In other words, both God's judgment and his goodness, God's judgment and his mercy are seen in this psalm, and both leads to the praise of God from those who put their trust in him. And trust, we learn in this verse, means waiting on the Lord, waiting patiently. That waiting obviously means not taking personal vengeance, not trying to help God's plan along, not trying to hurry God up, all of those kind of things, waiting patiently. And again, remember David's situation at this time, especially as compared to Doeg's situation. But we learned that those that wait on the Lord in Psalm 25:3, we're told, will not be ashamed, will never come to shame or being confounded when you are waiting on the Lord. And not only that, Psalm 37, verses 9 and 34 also assure that those that wait on the Lord will inherit the land. So again, we see that contrast between Doeg, the wicked, those that trust in their riches, those that don't put their trust in God, they're going to be rooted out of the land of the living. Those that trust in God and those that wait on Him, they're going to be planted in God's presence and they're going to inherit the land. Speaking of God's name, of course, refers to God's reputation, and it's almost a shorthand way to resting in God's promises. When God makes a promise, in a sense, His name is on the line. His very character, His very integrity is on the line. The word for saints that is used here is the hasadim. That refers to the community of those in covenant relationship with Yahweh, those that are the beneficiaries of Yahweh's hesed. All right, let's go to our interpretation. Psalm 52 teaches the common wisdom lesson of the future inheritance. There's a future inheritance for the wicked, the foolish, and there's a future inheritance for the wise, the righteous. So the wicked and foolish, they inherit death, and the righteous or the wise inherit life. This wisdom leads the righteous to wait patiently and trust in the Lord, even when the wicked seem to be prospering all around. Because ultimately, wisdom knows that the wicked will be uprooted and they will be cast away, that God is in full control and their destruction only awaits His time. That doesn't mean that we may not be in a tight spot. You know, David, I'm sure at first as he comes to the cave of Adullam and he's all alone and, you know, he's no doubt wondering, you know, what's he going to do, and sorting through, no doubt, God's words in his mind. It doesn't mean that we're not in a tight spot, but it does mean that we know ultimately how these things are going to come out. Those that prosper through wickedness and deceit and evil and all of those things, they will not come to life. They're on the pathway of death. Psalm 52 also teaches the need to go the right way despite the opposition. So David was one who refused to stretch out his hand against God's anointed king, Saul. And it comes out time and again. David had opportunities, and he would not take Saul's life. And though he had been anointed by Samuel, he had been prophesied to be the next king, David did not take matters into his own hands. He did not try to seize the throne to be there. He trusted in the Lord, and he continued to fight for Israel. During that time, even though probably most of Israel was against him. On the other hand, Doeg was an opportunist. One of Ahimelech's sons escaped and from that slaughter. His name was Abiathar, and he went to David, and he told David what had happened. And that's, again, David had feared that would happen because he saw Doeg there in Nob. So all this bloodshed that was brought about through Doeg's lying words, all of that was evil. And there were many, many, many in Israel, in Saul's army, who went along with it, who endorsed it. And David stood against it. Well, this psalm shows us the end of those who love evil, those who love lying, those who turn right and wrong upside down. It shows us also the end for those who pursue righteousness and peace and put their trust in God so that they patiently wait on Him. Well, that brings us to the messianic hope in this psalm. And the messianic hope is seen particularly in a couple of important connections. So this psalm does have connections with the psalms that come before it here in book 2 of the Psalms. So particularly those Korahite psalms in Psalms 42 to 49. Then you have the Psalm of Asaph in Psalm 50, and then you have David's confession in Psalm 51. But that Korahite psalm group, we now are entering into a string of Davidic psalms that's going to really come pretty much finish out book 2 collection of the psalms. And if you look at these psalms, like Psalm 51, through Psalm 70, they do show a progression similar to the progression of the Korahite Psalms. So when we went through the Korahite Psalms, we noticed how that they began with exile, with destruction of Jerusalem. They began with enemies having the upper hand. As we progress along, we have the coming of the king. Then we have the defeat of the enemies. We have Jerusalem built up and established. We have all of this victory with the coming of the king and his kingdom. So as we look at these early David Psalms, we realize that they center around his persecution from Saul mainly. So they also represent this being in exile, being cut off. So the Korahite Psalm groups, we kind of had, they led up to all this victory, and then we kind of had a couple of splashes of cold water that brought back to the reality of why are you suffering in exile? And what is going to be required to get out of it, walking through that valley? So we see that in Psalm 50 and Psalm 51. 52, David, as he's essentially cut off from in exile. He's fleeing from Saul. He's cut off from the tabernacle. He's being persecuted. He's cut off from God's people. He, you know, later distributes his family among the Moabites and what have you. So that's how we start this group of David Psalms. And as we progress through them, we're going to see them also make that same progression, where ultimately, as you get to the latter Psalms in this group, David's going to get to Jerusalem, and he's going to put down his enemies. And we're going to see very similar to what we saw in the Korah Psalms. So David is in exile in this psalm, and he is sustained by the hope of the victory to come when God destroys his enemies. That's what he looks forward to here in this psalm. So that brings us to the second connection. This psalm pits God's anointed king against an enemy that is opposing him. Now, obviously, this immediately reminds us of Psalm 2 and how that the rulers and the kings of the earth are raging against and opposing God and setting themselves against God. And one of the chief ways that they do that is by opposing his anointed king. Well, this particular enemy in this psalm is also an Edomite. Edom was the people that descended from Esau, and they were the perennial enemy of Israel. In fact, right after Saul became king, he began fighting Edom and some of the other surrounding nations. Now, some of the Edomites defected. They came over to join themselves to Saul. Doeg was one of those. They decided that it was a better opportunity to join Saul and Israel rather than fighting against them. And that was how Doeg came to be in Saul's service as well. The Edomites opposed Israel when they came out of Egypt, when they were on their way into the land of Canaan. And because of that, judgment against them was prophesied by Balaam in the fourth oracle that Balaam delivers in Numbers chapter 24, verses 16 to 19 in particular. And what Balaam saw was, he said he saw a star coming out of Jacob, and he saw a scepter rising out of Israel and destroying Moab and Sheth and conquering Edom and Seir. And he went on to say that this one that comes out of Jacob will come and will reign. Well, this conquering king was already prophesied by Jacob himself to come out of Judah in Genesis chapter 49, verses 9 to 12. So what I'm saying is, David knows that his anointed son will come to destroy the Edomites and all the evildoers, to root them out of the earth and to give the righteous their inheritance in the earth. So even though David is the one who's vulnerable and alone and he's running for his life, he's confident in God's promises and his seed who is yet to be born, who will tread down all of his enemies and reign from Zion in Jerusalem. So David certainly sees himself here in this conflict with the Edomite, again, as a figure of his seed, his son who was to come. All right, application. Just went with one application here. Understanding Psalm 52 helps us understand patience in the face of prospering enemies. And what a difficult lesson that can be. Our society and our government is daily turning good upside down, calling good evil, calling evil good, praising evil, codifying evil within the laws and statutes of our land. And we are witnessing a downward spiral, much like what Paul wrote about in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. So, what we understand when faced with that sort of a situation and reading a psalm like Psalm 52 is that we don't have to despair. We should not despair. We don't have the upper hand. Enemies of God are opposing and persecuting and growing bolder, but they will meet their destruction one day. Now, obviously, we do what we can within what we've been given within our government and those lawful and peaceful avenues that we have to oppose evil. We certainly do that. But when we look out and we think about all the injustice and all the bloodshed and all the covetousness and all the theft and all the lying in high places, we understand it will not go unpunished. No matter how great that they may grow through doing it. So we are helped by considering their end. David here, perhaps he composed this psalm when he was in the cave and over these events. I don't know exactly when he wrote it. We just know that what this occasion was. So David is running for his life. He's alone. He's vulnerable. All of these things. But David was helped here by considering the end, by considering that outcome. The end for those that love evil and pursue it and love lying and pursue it, it's not power and influence and wealth, though that may be gained in the short term. No, the outcome for them is death. It's judgment. And the outcome for those who trust and wait on the Lord, well, that's not going to be power and influence and wealth and all of that in this world either. It's going to be inheritance in the earth in Christ's kingdom for all of those who trust in Him. Blessing and peace forevermore, as opposed to suffering and condemnation eternally.